WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're closing out the summer season with a retrospective featuring some of our favorite interviews from the recent past. Because Sherwin Nuland is a doctor, he's witnessed many deaths. In his best-selling book, How We Die, he writes that nowadays very few of us actually witness the deaths of those we love, so an entire mythology has grown up around the process of dying. In his book, he attempts to present death in its biological and clinical reality. He says only by a frank discussion of the very details of dying can we best deal with those aspects that frighten us the most. Dr. Nuland teaches surgery and the history of medicine at Yale. I spoke with him in February. We all hope to die a good death, but Dr. Nuland writes, the good death is a myth, and the chief ingredient of that myth is death with dignity.
We have this idea, which is propagated by books, by articles that we see in journals and in newspapers, that death somehow is a noble series of events that culminates in the great deathbed scene of the dying person, or perhaps the patriarchal person surrounded by loved ones, and he or she is imparting final wisdom, and there are no strands left untied. That almost never happens, and when it does happen, it's an absolute coincidence and has very little to do with the life of the person that occurred before that final period of life.
You feel you've rarely seen death with dignity?
One of the points I try to make in this book, and I make it a number of times in a number of different ways, is that what gives dignity to death is the dignity of the life that preceded it. When we have brought about a situation where we are loved and we love, where our lives have been lives not necessarily of great accomplishment, but of a sense of having given something to others, whether those others are as close to us as our children or parents, or whether those others are as far away as a radio or television audience, when we have done that, our deaths have dignity. Our deaths become a part of our lives in the sense that with our deaths, we give something to those who are left behind, as we have given our lives to them.
In your book, you write about something very personal that happened to you, and that was your brother had colon cancer. Colon cancer had killed your mother when you were 11. So when your brother got colon cancer, he asked you to be his doctor and to, you know, help him decide what he should do. And you say in your book that you had discovered how much the cancer had spread and how far gone his condition was, but you didn't want to tell him the extent to which the cancer was spreading. You were afraid of telling your brother the truth. You were afraid it would take away his hope. Why did you make that decision to not tell him the truth?
Well, first, I have to point out that I wasn't his doctor. Actually, I've always followed a philosophy of choosing the best doctors I can for people in my family who become sick, and then just agreeing with what they think is appropriate if it seems reasonable. And that's what I did in my brother's situation. He was in another city. He was here in New York City, and of course I was in New Haven, and I watched this process unfold. What actually happened was that he was operated upon, and the finding was a very far advanced malignancy, which from every bit of clinical knowledge I had, and this is a disease that I treat every day of my life in New Haven, every bit of clinical knowledge I had could not possibly be cured. I told my brother he had cancer. I told my brother there was cancer in his liver. I did not want to beat him over the head by telling him there was fluid in his abdomen and there were cancer cells in the fluid and there were dots of cancer on virtually every intraperitoneal, intraabdominal organ. I didn't see at that point the sense in that, but the mistake that I made by not telling him everything was to make him think that there was a possibility that something could be done. What was even worse was that when I looked at him, my boyhood friend, you know, we had gone through so much together through all these years, when I looked at him, I saw in his eyes myself reflected, the smart kid brother who'd gone off to Yale and become a doctor, and I should be able to save him. So I began looking around, is there something new? Is there something new? And my God, there was an experimental therapy that I knew perfectly well stood only a small chance of getting him through. But foolishly, at that time, I thought of hope as being the hope of cure, the hope of rescue. And I followed the philosophy that anything is better than death. So what I did was to put him through, this was at my suggestion, my recommendation, a series of chemotherapy treatments that stood only a very small chance of curing him. And what I succeeded in doing was to take away an opportunity for some months of being with his family at peace, slowly dying of this disease. And what I exchanged for it was a death that was terribly, terribly difficult. And I have not forgiven myself for it. I should not forgive myself for it. And I write about it in the book because I wanted people to know that with the very, very, very best of intentions, what we sometimes think of as something very good for those we love turns out to be very bad for those we love, because had I been a detached clinical physician in New Haven and such a patient had presented himself to me, I would have said, don't do this chemotherapy protocol. It's senseless. You stand only a small chance of cure. We shouldn't do it. But this was my brother. And so I lost all my objectivity, and I tried it.
But let me ask you, had you not tried it, after your brother died, might you have been wondering, say, we tried that therapy. Sure, there was only a small percentage it would have helped him, but it might have. Maybe I should have given it a shot.
That's one of the reasons I tried it.
Uh-huh.
I didn't want to have to later on say, I should have given it a shot. But that's exactly what I mean when I say it's with the best of intentions that we carry out these exercises in futility. We want to do the right thing. But what we should do is step back and let more objective people make such decisions.
I recently read an article in the New York Times that talked about how difficult it is now for patients to make decisions about what course of therapy to take or whether to not take any at all because it's hopeless. And, you know, doctors have given us the chance to participate in the decisions. On the other hand, to participate intelligently, you nearly have to become a doctor yourself sometimes. Is this a dilemma for you as a doctor, how much a patient needs to know in order to kind of participate in an educated way in one of these big decisions?
Well, I think that's a major problem. We were taught in my day in medical school, and certainly that continued into the 60s, 70s, and 80s, to be what's called a paternalistic physician. Only we can understand the proper course of therapy in any disease. I tell the story in the book of a 92-year-old woman who had a perforated ulcer of a duodenum, and she came in with peritonitis, and she wanted to die. She had no relatives. She really felt she had nothing to look forward to. And I said, Miss Welsh, you know, there's a 1 in 3 chance, and you have to be crazy not to take a 1 in 3 chance. I talked her into it. She survived the operation, but she had a stroke a few weeks later when she was back at the convalescent hospital, and she died. And I realized, looking back on the whole situation, that I had taken my value system and enforced it on her. In my value system, as a high-tech surgeon in a university teaching hospital, a 1 in 3 chance was certainly appropriate to take. Anything is better than death. Well, you know, that's not true. It's not so that anything is better than death. As a wise oncology nurse said to me, there are many people, more than you would dream, and many of our listeners, I think, probably fall into this category, for whom what you have to go through in order to come out on the other side alive is simply not worth the effort. I've seen so many patients, particularly elderly patients over the years, who become debilitated and changed by the process by which I cure them or another doctor cures them. And has it really been worth it?
Let's get back to this patient who is in her 90s, Hazel Welch. And she, you thought there was a 1 in 3 chance that surgery would save her life. She really didn't want to go through with it, but you talked her into it. What would you have done today?
Well, here comes the great moral dilemma. I say in the book very clearly, if I had thought more objectively and intelligently about this, I would have said, Ms. Welsh, you're right. I've looked on the face sheet of your chart, and your closest of kin is a trust officer at the bank, the man who takes care of your money. There is nobody in this world whose life would be affected right now by your death. This woman had leukemia. She was in remission from leukemia. She had severe gangrenous changes in her toe. She was about to lose her toe. She really didn't have a lot to look forward to. So I say in the book, well, you know, if I knew then and thought then the way I know now and think now, I would have let her die as she wished. And then I start the next paragraph, and I'll remind you of it by saying, no, that's a lie. What I've written is a lie. Suppose I had let her die. Well, on Thursday afternoon at 5 o'clock at the Yale New Haven Hospital, there's a conference called Mortality and Morbidity. I would have had to explain to my colleagues what I had done, and they would look at me as if I were nuts, or worse than nuts, if I were dangerous, and say, what right did you have to let a 92-year-old woman make a decision like that? You've been a surgeon for 30 years, and you let some old lady living in a convalescent hospital decide whether she should die of peritonitis. That's not her decision. That's a clinical decision, they would say. That's not an ethical decision. Leave morals and morality and ethics to the ethicists and the ministers and the who knows what's. Your job as a physician is to do the best thing you can to save her life. Now, we have to respect that point of view, but I just want listeners and patients to know that that isn't their point of view, that doctors have an agenda which is very often quite different than the agenda of the patients they're treating. And I'm deliberately talking about the very best doctors, and we all like to think that our doctors are the very best, and in the United States we have a remarkably high percentage of very finely trained doctors, very highly motivated doctors. A doctor is in the business of curing disease. He is not what I call a pastor. He's a clinical physician. When I reach the end of my life, there are going to be a lot of things that go into my deciding whether I want to continue or not. And this is true for you, Terry. This is true for every listener. It is not a clinical decision. It's a personal, a moral, a social, a religious, a spiritual decision. The doctor can help me with part of that, but he can't help me with all of it.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Sherwin Nuland, and we're talking about the subject of his new book, How We Die. We're going to take a short break, and then Dr. Nuland will talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Dr. Sherwin Nuland, author of How We Die. We've all heard reports of near-death experiences where instead of enduring agony right at the end, people who've nearly died and come back and tell us about it, tell us about this feeling of tranquility, of a glowing light that they saw, of a sense of being at peace. Do you have patients who've told you about that after they nearly died?
Yes, I have, and I have had a recent patient who 2 months ago told me about being rushed to the operating room with a dreadful peritonitis, and I had operated on her, and I didn't find out until much later that she had a vision of her father, who had died 10 years before, telling her that she would survive. I think these kinds of things happen. I think they are real. I don't think anybody invents them, but I think I have an explanation for them. As I and other doctors have tried to make some analogy between these experiences and things that we actually see in clinical practice, there is an analogy. And the analogy is that some patients, when given morphine-like compounds, not only have a sense of relief of pain, but they have a sense of tranquility, and some patients will even have visions. And I think that what happens in these near-death experiences is that compounds called endorphins, which are morphine-like compounds produced inside of one, that's where the name comes from, end meaning inside, orphan, morphine-like endorphins, are produced in large amounts, and that's been tested. Trauma victims who've had such severe bleeding that they bled into shock can be demonstrated to have high levels of endorphins. I think this happens with many trauma patients. I think it happens with coronary patients, and I attribute these kinds of visions to the large increase in endorphins that can easily be demonstrated in the laboratory.
But can you predict from the type of disease one has or a certain kind of accident one could experience, whether the last sensation before death would be one of agony or one of, you know, this kind of bathed in a warm presence.
I don't think so. The bathed in the warm presence, of course, is much more frequently described in situations of injury, sudden death.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it's coronary artery disease, but more likely it's an injury, most specifically an injury that has to do with considerable blood loss.
Like a car accident.
Like a car accident, yes, or like the stabbing that I describe in the book of the little girl who was killed by a homicidal maniac who died with this expression on her face that indicated to her mother and to me, as I was told about it, that she did not die in pain or terror.
So you think that the endorphins might be more likely to be released in trauma than at the end of a cancer death?
Yes, and I think it has evolutionary value for our species, Terry. I think that what this represents is, of course, that in prehistoric times, trauma was a very common cause of death, whether people fighting each other or the old saber-toothed tiger invading the village. People who panic in the presence of trauma are much more likely to die. So people capable of making a lot of endorphins and remaining somewhat tranquil are more likely to live to reproduce. So over the course of millions of years, we have developed a species very likely to put out large amounts of endorphins when something suddenly traumatic happens.
You're a doctor. You have witnessed many other people's deaths, including, you know, deaths of people very close to you. And you know about how a dying person can lose control in a hospital, for instance. Are you kind of preparing documents now so that if, like, you know, some point in the future you find yourself with a chronic illness or something in a hospital, the doctor proceeds in such a way that would follow your wishes?
You know that there's now a federal law requiring that every patient entering a hospital have the opportunity to provide such documents so that there will be no question should mm-hmm. a patient become comatose or unable to make a conscious decision, there will be no question about what that patient wants done at the end of life. And if I can urge our listeners to do anything, it's to take those directives very, very seriously. Look over the papers you are given if you go into a hospital and make a decision about what you want done.
So are you preparing any documents now? Or
I myself.
Yeah.
I have not prepared any documents, but I have told my four children, I have told my wife exactly what I want done under which circumstances, because to my mind, of course I will prepare a document if I'm admitted to a hospital, but to my mind, the most important thing is not the legality of the document, but the knowledge for those who are left behind that whatever that decision they make to end my life is the right decision and they don't have to live with any sense of guilt about it.
Well, that's interesting. So the main thing you're trying to tell them is that you kind of trust them and that they don't have to be racked with agony about whether they made the right choice or not.
The main thing I'm trying to tell them by everything I do every day is what sort of person I am. And the sort of person I am, and I suspect this is true of the great majority of your listeners, is a person who would not want extreme measures to be taken when a wise physician thinks that it's futile to do it.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that concerns you about hospitals, you point out statistically that many more people die in hospitals now than ever before, and you think that that often robs the dying people and the people who love them from any kind of like final deathbed experience together. It often doesn't. It doesn't always. Often people are at the hospital at that time, but often they're not. Have you ever been at the deathbed of a loved one when they were going?
I have never personally been at the bedside of someone I loved when they died. That's not what counts, because much of the time, I would say perhaps most of the time, the person who is dying during the last hours or perhaps even the last day is not completely aware of what's happening. What's important is to live through the process of dying with this person. People overemphasize the last hour or the last minute. What counts is the process that's leading toward death. That's when people need to have the concordance with loved ones that's so important. The help, the support, it's during the pain and the mess and the misery that most of us will die in that we need those we love. There is no tying together of strings at the last hour. That's a very rare phenomenon. It's the thing of romance. It's the thing of movies and television. It's not the thing of real life. The thing of real life and the time a dying person needs the family and the loved ones the most is during that awful time when he or she is going through the weeks preceding those final hours.
One more thing. You talk about how doctors have always been taught to give their patients hope even if the patient is dying. But you write about the need to redefine hope. How do you define hope now, the kind of hope you want to give a dying patient?
Well, let me define hope in a meaningful way, at least a way that's meaningful to me. You know, if we were going to use a dictionary definition of hope and look them all up, we would find out that the one thing that brings them all together is the belief that some good thing may yet happen. The good thing that may yet happen during dying is not the possibility of survival when we're beyond that point. The good thing that may yet happen is that our lives will have great meaning for those we leave behind. To me, the hope that can exist at the time of death is the hope of our heritage, that we have really meant something to people, whether they are our own children or friends or students, whatever, or people who listen to us on the radio. That's the hope. The hope that your heritage is something good for others. And I think when you think of death as being part of the life cycle and recognize that death is an inevitability for our species because the world has to be renewed with each death, then the hope becomes, when it is renewed, it will be renewed by people on whom I have had some influence for good.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Dr. Sherwin Nuland is the author of How We Die. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.